to the accompaniment of screeching metal. It turned as he watched, colliding with the after part of the ship as it rotated in the water like a small berg. There was movement at an exposed watertight door. He saw a man try to get free and succeed, the figure jumping into the water and swimming away from the wallowing bow. The bridge crew was alive, all cut by flying glass, but at their posts. Chief Clark took a quick look at the pilot house, then ran below to assist with damage control. The damage control parties were already racing forward with fire hoses and welding gear. And, at Damage Control Central, the men examined the trouble board to see how severe the flooding was. Morris lifted a sound-powered phone and twisted the dial to this compartment.
Damage Control report.
Flooding aft to frame 36, but I think she'll float. For a little while, anyway. No fires. Waiting for reports now. Morris switched settings on the phone.
Combat, radio the screen commander that we've taken a hit and need assistance.
Done, sir. Gallery's heading out this way. Looks like the sub got away. They're still searching for her. We have some shock damage here. All the radars are down. Bow sonar is out. Azrock is out. The tail is still working, though, and the Mark 32 mounts still work.
Wait, screen commander's sending us a tug, sir.
Okay, you have the con. I'm going below to look at the damage.
You have the con, Morris thought. How do you con a ship that ain't moving? A minute later, he was at a bulkhead, watching men trying to shore it up with lumber.
This one's fairly solid, sir. The next one forward's leaking like a damn sieve. No way we'll patch it all. When the bow let go, it must have twisted everything loose.
The officer grabbed a seaman by the shoulder.
Go to the after DC locker and get more 4x4s.
Will this one hold?
I don't know. Clark is checking the bottom out now. We'll have to weld in some patches and stiffeners. Give me about 10 minutes and I'll tell you if she'll float or not.
Clark appeared. He was breathing heavily.
The bulkhead sprung at the tank tops and there's a small crack too. Leaking pretty good. The pumps are on and just about keeping even. I think we can shore it up, but we have to hustle.
The damage control officer led the welders below at once. Two men appeared with a portable pump. Morris ordered them below.
How many men missing? Morris asked Chief Clark.
He was holding his arm strangely.
All the guys made it out of the 5-inch mount, but I haven't seen anybody from below decks. Shit, I think I broke something myself.
Clark looked at his right arm and shook his head angrily.
I don't think many guys made it out of the bow, sir. The watertight doors are twisted some. They gotta be jammed tight.
Get that arm looked at, Morris ordered.
Oh, fuck the arm, skipper. You need me.
The man was right. Morris went back topside with Clark behind him. On reaching the bridge, Morris dialed up engineering. The noise on the phone answered his first question. The engineer spoke over the hiss of escaping steam.
Shock damage, Captain. We got some ruptured steam pipes on the number one boiler. I think number two will still work, but I've popped the safeties on both just in case. The diesel generators are online. I got some hurt men here. I'm sending them out.
Okay, we just did a check of number two boiler. A few minor leaks, but we can fix them quick. Otherwise, everything looks pretty tight. I can have it back online in 15 minutes.
We need it.
Morris hung up. Farris lay dead in the water. With the safety valves opened, steam vented onto the massive stacked structure, giving off a dreadful rasping sound that seemed like the ship's own cry of pain. The frigate's sleek clipper bow had been replaced by a flat face of torn metal and hanging wires. The water around the ship was foul with oil from ruptured fuel tanks. For the first time, Morris noticed that the ship was down by the stern. When he stood straight, the ship was misaligned. He knew he had to wait for another damage control report. As with an accident victim, the prognosis depended on the work of surgeons, and they could not be rushed or disturbed. He lifted the phone to CIC.
Combat, bridge, what's the status of that submarine contact?
Gallery's helo dropped on it, but
but the torp ran dry without hitting anything. Looks like he ran northeast, but we haven't had anything for about 5 minutes. There's an Orion in the area now.
Tell them to check inside of us. This character isn't going to run away unless he has to. He might be running in, not out. Tell the screen commander.
Aye, Cap'n.
He hadn't hung the phone up when it buzzed.
Captain speaking.
She'll float, sir, the damage control officer said at once. We're patching the bulkhead now. It won't be tight, but the pumps can handle the leakage. Unless something else goes bad on us, we'll get her home.
They sending the tug out to us?
Yes. If we get a tow, sir, it better be stern first. I don't want to think about trying to run this one into a seaway.
Right. Morris looked at Clark. Get a gang of men aft. We'll be taking the tow at the stern, rig it up. Have them launch the whaleboat to look for survivors. I saw at least one man in the water. And get a sling on that arm.
You got it, Captain.
Clark moved aft.
Morris went to CIC and found a working radio.
X-ray Alpha, this is Ferris, Morris called to the screen commander.
State your condition.
We took one hit forward. The bow has gone all the way to the ASRock launcher. We cannot maneuver. I can keep her afloat unless we hit some bad weather. Both boilers currently down, but we should have power back in less than 10 minutes. We have casualties, but I don't know how many or how bad yet.
Commodore, we got hit by a nuke boat, probably a Victor. Unless I miss my guess, he's headed your way.
We lost him, but he was heading out, the Commodore said.
Start looking inside, sir, Morris urged. This fellow got to knife-fighting range and pulled a beautiful number on us. This one isn't going to run away for long. He's too damn good for that.
The Commodore thought that one over briefly.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. Gallery's en route to you. What other assistance do you need?
You need Gallery more than we do. Just send us the tug, Morris answered.
He knew that the submarine wouldn't be coming back to finish the kill. He'd accomplished that part of his mission. Next, he'd try to kill some merchants.
Roger that. Let me know if you need anything else. Good luck, Ed.
Thank you, sir. Out.
Morris ordered his helo to drop a double ring of sonoboys around his ship, just in case. Then the Sea Sprite found 3 men in the water, one of them dead. The whaleboat recovered them, allowing the helo to rejoin the convoy. It was assigned to Gallery, which took Ferris's station as the convoy angled south. Below, welders worked their gear in waist-deep salt water as they struggled to seal off the breaks in the frigate's watertight bulkheads. The task lasted 9 hours. Then the pumps drained the water from the flooded compartments. Before they had finished, the fleet tug Papago pulled alongside the frigate's square stern. Chief Clark supervised as a stout towing wire was passed across and secured. An hour later, the tug was pulling the frigate on an easterly course at 4 knots, backwards to protect the damaged bow. Morris ordered his towed-array sonar to be strung over the bow, trailing it out behind to give them some small defense capability. Several extra lookouts were posted to watch for periscopes. It would be a slow, dangerous trip back home.
Chapter 28 Breakthroughs.
Stendal, German Democratic Republic.
Be careful, Pasha.
As always, Comrade General, Alexeyev smiled.
Come, Captain.
Sergeyev fell in behind his superior. Unlike during their previous frontline outing, both men wore protective body armor. The general carried only a sidearm to go along with his map case, but the captain was now officially a bodyguard, in addition to a staff officer, and had a small Czech submarine gun slung over his shoulder. He was a different man today, the captain saw. On Alexeyev's first trip to the front, he'd been tentative, almost hesitant in manner. It hadn't occurred to the younger man that, as senior as Alexeyev was, he had never seen combat before, and had approached this gravest of contests with the same sort of apprehension as a new private. no longer. He had smelled the smoke. Now he knew how things worked or didn't work. The change was remarkable. His father was right, Sergeyev thought. He was a man to be reckoned with. They were joined in their helicopter by an Air Force colonel. The Mi-24 lifted off in darkness, its fighter escort overhead. Lammersdorf, Federal Republic of Germany. Not many people appreciated the importance of the video cassette recorder. A useful convenience for the home, to be sure, but not until a captain in the Royal Dutch Air Force had demonstrated a bright idea 2 years before, had its battlefield utility been proven in secret exercises, first in Germany, then in the western United States. NATO radar surveillance aircraft kept their customary positions high over the Rhine. The E-3A Sentry aircraft, better known as AWACS, and the smaller, lesser-known TR-1, flew their missions in boring circles or straight lines far behind the fighting front. They had similar but different functions. The AWACS was mainly concerned with air traffic. The TR-1, an upgraded version of the venerable U-2, looked for vehicles on the ground. Initially, the TR-1 had been something of a failure. Because it tracked too many targets, many of them immobile radar reflectors set everywhere by the Soviets, the NATO commanders had been deluged with information that was too disordered to use. Then came the VCR. All the data relayed from the aircraft was recorded on videotape anyway, since it was a convenient medium for data storage. But the VCRs built into the NATO system possessed only a few operating features. The Dutch captain thought to bring his personal machine into his office, and demonstrated how, by using fast forward and fast reverse, the radar data could be used to show not only where things were going, but also where they had come from. Computer support made the task easier by eliminating items that moved no more than once every 2 hours, thus erasing the Russian radar lures. And there it was, a brand new intelligence tool. With several copies made of each tape, a staff of over 100 intelligence and traffic control experts examined the data round the clock. Some engaged in straight tactical intelligence. Others looked for patterns. A large number of trucks moving at night to and from frontline units could only mean shuttle runs to fuel and ammunition dumps. A number of vehicles breaking away from a divisional convoy and deploying in line parallel to the front meant artillery preparing for an attack. The real trick, they had learned, was to get the data to the forward commanders quickly enough so they could make use of it. At Lammersdorf, a Belgian lieutenant was just finishing up a tape that was 6 hours old, and his report was sent by landline to the forward NATO commanders. At least three divisions had been moved north and south on Autobahn 7, he reported. The Soviets would attack at Bad Salzdetfurt in strength, sooner than expected. Immediately, reserve units from the Belgian, German, and American armies were rushed forward, and Allied air units alerted for a major land action. Fighting in this sector had been vicious enough already. The German forces covering the area south of Hanover were at less than 50% strength, and the battle that had not yet begun was already a race, as both sides tried to get reserves to the point of attack before the other. Holle, Federal Republic of Germany. 30 minutes, Alexeyev told Sergeyev. Four motor rifle divisions were online, covering a front of less than 20 kilometers. Behind them a tank division waited to exploit the first breach in German lines. The objective was the town of Ulfeld, on the Leine River. The town commanded two roads being used by NATO to shuttle units and supplies north and south, and its capture would open a breach in the NATO lines, allowing the Soviet operational maneuver groups to burst into NATO's rear. "Comrade General, how are things progressing, in your opinion?" the captain asked quietly. "Ask me in a few hours," the general answered.
The river valley to his rear was yet another wasteland of men and arms. They were only 30 kilometers from the border, and the Red Army's tanks had been expected to reach Hola in only 2 days. Alexeyev frowned, wondering what staff genius had come up with that timetable. Again the human factor had been overlooked. The morale and fighting spirit of the Germans was like nothing he had ever seen. He remembered his father's stories of the battles across the Ukraine and Poland, but he had never quite believed them. He believed them now. The Germans contested every lump of dirt in their country like wolves defending their cubs, retreating only when they were forced to, counterattacking at every opportunity, draining the blood from the advancing Russian units as they brought every weapon they had to bear. Soviet doctrine had predicted heavy losses. The battle of movement could be achieved only by costly frontal assault, which first had to blast a hole in the front lines. But the NATO armies were denying that hole to the Soviets. Their sophisticated weapons, firing from safe, prepared positions, were ripping through each attack wave. Their aircraft attacks in the Soviet rear sapped the strength of units before they could be committed to decisive battle, and played hob with artillery support, despite the most careful deceptive measures. The Red Army was moving forward, Alexeyev reminded himself, and NATO was paying its own price. Their reserves were also being thinned out. The German forces were not using their mobility, as Alexeyev would have, too often tying themselves to geographic locations instead of fighting the Soviet forces on the move. Of course, the general thought, they didn't have very much terrain to trade for time. He checked his watch. A sheet of flame rose from the forests below him as Russian artillery began its preparatory bombardment. Next came the multiple rocket launchers, and the morning sky was alight with streaks of fire. Alexeyev turned his binoculars downrange. In a few seconds he saw the orange-white explosions of the rounds as they impacted on NATO lines. He was too far from the fighting front to see any detail, but an area that had to be many kilometers across lit up like the neon signs so popular in the West. There was a roar overhead, and the general saw the leading elements of the ground attack fighters racing to the front.
"Thank you, Comrade General," Alexeyev breathed.
He counted at least 30 Sukhoi and MiG fighter bombers, all hugging the ground as they headed toward the battle line. His face crinkled into a determined smile as he walked into the command bunker. "The lead elements are moving now," a colonel announced. On a table made of rough planks laid across sawhorses, grease pencil marks were made on the tactical maps. Red arrows began their march toward a series of blue lines. The plotters were all lieutenants, and each wore a telephone headset linked to a specific regimental headquarters. The officers connected to reserve units stood away from the table, puffing on their cigarettes as they watched the march of the arrows. Behind them, the commander of 8th Guards Army stood quietly, watching his plan of attack unfold. "Meeting moderate resistance. Enemy artillery and tank fire is being encountered," a lieutenant said. Explosions rocked the command bunker. 2 kilometers away, a flight of German Phantoms had just torn into a battalion of mobile guns. "Enemy fighters overhead," the air defense officer said belatedly. A few eyes looked apprehensively up at the log ceiling of the bunker. Alexeyev's didn't join them. A NATO smart bomb would kill them all in a blink. Much as he enjoyed his post as deputy commander of the theater, he wished himself back to the days when he had commanded a fighting division. Here he was only an observer, and felt the need to have the reins in his own 2 hands. "Artillery reports heavy counter-battery fire and air attacks. Our missiles are engaging enemy aircraft in the 57th Motor Rifle Division's rear area," the air defense officer went on. "Heavy air activity over the front." "Our fighters are engaging NATO aircraft," the frontal aviation officer reported.
He looked up angrily.
"Friendly SAMs are shooting down our fighters!"
"Air defense officer," Alexeyev shouted, "tell your units to identify their targets."
"We have 50 aircraft over the front. We can handle the NATO fighters alone," the aviator insisted.
"Tell all SAM batteries to hold fire on all targets above 1,000 meters," Alexeyev ordered.
He had discussed this with his frontal aviation commander the night before. The MiG pilots were to stay high after making their own attack runs, leaving the missile and gun batteries free to engage only those NATO aircraft that were an immediate threat to ground units. Why were his own planes getting hit?
30,000 feet over the Rhine, two NATO E-3A radar aircraft fought for their lives. A determined Soviet attack was underway, two regiments of MiG-23 interceptors rocketing through the sky toward them. The onboard controllers were calling for help. This both distracted them from countering the attack and stripped fighters from other missions. Heedless of their own safety, the Russians came west at over 1,000 miles per hour with heavy jamming support. American F-15 Eagles and French Mirage jets converged on the threat, filling the sky with missiles. It was not enough. When the MiGs got to within 60 miles, the AWACS aircraft shut down their radars and dove for the ground to evade the attack. The NATO fighters over Bad Salzdetfurt were on their own. For the first time, the Soviets had achieved air superiority over a major battlefield.
143rd Guards Rifle Regiment reports they have broken through German lines, a lieutenant said.
He didn't look up, but extended the arrow for which he was responsible. Enemy units retreating in disarray.
145th Guards checking in, reported the plotting officer next to him. The first line of German resistance has collapsed, proceeding south along the axis of the rail line. Enemy units are on the run. They are not regrouping, not attempting to turn.
The general commanding 8th Guards Army gave Alexeyev a triumphant look.
Get that tank division moving!
The two understrength German brigades covering this sector had suffered too much, been called upon to stop too many attacks. Their men spent, their weapons depleted. They had no choice but to run from the enemy, hoping to form a new line in the woods behind Highway 243. At Hackenstedt, 4 kilometers away, 20th Guards Tank Division started moving down the road. Its 300 T-80 main battle tanks, supported by several hundred more infantry assault carriers, spread left and right of the secondary road and formed its attack formation in columns of regiments. The 20th Tanks was the operation maneuver group for 8th Guards Army. Since the war had begun, the Soviet Army had been trying to break one of these powerful units into the NATO rear. It was now possible.
"Well done, Comrade General," Alexeyev said.
The plotting tables showed a general breakthrough. Three of the four attacking motor rifle divisions had broken through the German lines. The MiGs succeeded in killing one of the AWACS aircraft and three Eagle fighters, at the price of 19 of their own, in a furious air battle that lasted 15 minutes. The surviving AWACS was back at altitude now, 80 miles behind the Rhine, and its radar operators were working to re-establish control of the air battle over central Germany as the MiGs ran for home through a cloud of NATO surface-to-air missiles. At murderous cost, they had accomplished a mission for which they had not even been briefed.
But this was only the beginning. Now that the initial attack had succeeded, the most difficult part of the battle was underway. The generals and colonels commanding the attack had to move their units forward rapidly, careful to keep the formations intact as they leapfrogged their artillery southwest to provide continuous support for the advancing regiments. The tank division had the highest priority. It had to hit the next set of German lines only minutes behind the motor rifle troops in order to reach Alfeld before nightfall. Units of the field police established pre-planned traffic control points and directed units down roads whose marker signs had been removed by the Germans. Of course. The process was not as easy as might have been expected.
Units were not intact. Some commanders were dead. Vehicles had broken down, and damaged roads slowed traffic well below normal rates of advance. For their part, the German troops were trying to reorganize. Rearguard units lingered behind every turn in the road, pausing to loose their anti-tank missiles at the hard-charging Soviet advance guard, which took a particularly heavy toll of unit commanders. Allied aircraft were reorganizing also, and low-level attack fighters began to engage the Soviet units in the open. Behind the sundered battle line, a German tank brigade rolled into Alfeld, with a Belgian motorized regiment 10 minutes behind. The Germans proceeded northeast on the main road, watched by citizens who had just been ordered to evacuate their homes. Faslane, Scotland.
"No luck, eh?" asked Todd Sims, commander of USS Boston.
"None," McCafferty confirmed.
Even the trip into Faslane had been unlucky. The guard ship for the Safe Transit Corridor, HMS Osiris, had gotten into attack position without their having detected her. Had that Brit diesel sub been a Russian, McCafferty could very well be dead now.
"We had our big chance against that amphibious group. Things were going perfect, you know. The Russians had their sonoboy lines out, and we beat them clean. Just about had our targets lined up for the missile attack. I figured we'd hit with our missiles first, then go in with torpedoes."
"Sounds good to me," Sims agreed.
"And somebody else launches his own torpedo attack. Screwed everything up. We lofted 3 harpoons, but a helo saw us do it, and bingo! We had the bastards all over us."
McCafferty pulled open the door to the officers' club.
"I need a drink."
"Hell yes," Sims laughed. "Everything looks better after a few beers."
"Hey, that sort of thing happens. Luck changes, Danny."
Sims leaned over the bar.
"2 strong ones."
"As you say, Commander."
A white-coated steward drew 2 mugs of warm, dark beer. Sims picked up the bill and led his friend to a corner booth. There was some sort of small party going on at the far end of the room.
"Danny, for crying out loud, let up on yourself. Not your fault that Ivan didn't send you any targets, is it?"
McCafferty took a long pull on his mug. 2 miles away, Chicago was reprovisioning. They'd be in port for 2 days. Boston and another 688-class sub were tied to the same key, with another pair due in later today. They were to be outfitted for a special mission, but they didn't yet know what it was. In the meantime, the officers and crewmen were using their modicum of free time to breathe fresh air and unwind.
"You're right, Todd, right as ever."
"Good. Have some pretzels.
Looks like quite a shindig over there. How about we wander over?"
Sims lifted his beer and walked to the end of the room. They found a gathering of submarine officers, which was not a surprise, but the center of attention was. He was a Norwegian captain, a blond man of about 30, who clearly hadn't been sober for several hours. As soon as he drained 1 jar of beer, a Royal Navy commander handed him another.
"I must find the man who save us," the Norwegian insisted loudly and drunkenly.
"What gives?" Sims asked. Introductions were exchanged. The Royal Navy officer was captain of HMS Oberon.
"This is the chappie who blasted Kirov all the way back to Murmansk," he said. "He tells the story about every 10 minutes. About time for him to begin again."
"Son of a bitch," McCafferty said.
This was the guy who had sunk his target.
Sure enough, the Norwegian began speaking again.
"We make our approach slowly. They come right," he belched, "to us, and we creep very slow. I put periscope up, and there he is. 4,000 meters, 20 knots. He will pass within 500 meters starboard."
The beer mug swept toward the floor.
"Down, periscope. Arne, where are you, Arne? Oh, he's drunk at table. Arne is weapons officer. He's set to fire 4 torpedoes. Type 37 American torpedoes.
He gestured at the two American officers who had just joined the crowd.
4 Mark 37s. McCafferty winced at the thought. That could ruin your whole day.
Kirov is very close now. Up periscope. Course same, speed same. Distance now 2,000 meters. I shoot. 1, 2, 3, 4. Reload and dive deep.
You're the guy who ruined my approach, McCafferty shouted.
The Norwegian almost appeared sober for a moment.
Who are you?
Dan McCafferty, USS Chicago.
You over there?
Yes.
You shoot missiles?
Yes.
Hero!
The Norwegian submarine commander ran to McCafferty, almost knocking him down as he wrapped the American in a crushing bear hug.
You save my men! You save my ship!
What the hell is this? Sims asked.
Oh, introductions, said a Royal Navy captain. Captain Bjorn Johansson of His Norwegian Majesty's Submarine Cobham.
Captain Daniel McCafferty of USS Chicago.
After we shoot Kirov, they come around us like wolves. Kirov, blow up!
4 fish, I believe it, Sims agreed.
Russians come to us with cruiser, 2 destroyers,
Johansson continued, now quite sober.
We, evade, go deep. But they find us and fire their RBU rockets. Many, many rockets. Most far, some close. We reload, and I shoot at cruiser.
You hit her?
1 hit. Hurt, but not sink. This take, I am not sure, 10 minutes, 15. It was very busy time, yes?
Me too. We came in fast, flipped on the radar. There were 3 ships where we thought Kirov was.
Kirov was sunk. Blow up! What you see was cruiser and 2 destroyers. Then you shoot missiles, yes?
Johansson's eyes sparkled.
3 harpoons. A helix saw the launch and came after us. We evaded, never did know if the missiles hit anything.
Hit? Ha! Let me tell you!
Johansson gestured.
We dead. Battery down.
We have damage now. Cannot run.
We already evade 4 torpedoes, but they have us now. Sonar have us. Destroyer fire RBU at us. 3 miss, but they have us. Then, boom, boom, boom. Many more. Destroyer blow up. Other hit, but not sink, I think. We escape.
Johansson hugged McCafferty again, and both spilled their beer on the floor. The American had never seen a Norwegian display this much emotion, even around his wife.
My crew alive because of you, Chicago. I buy you drink. I buy all your men drink.
You are sure we killed that tin can?
You not kill, Johansson said. My ship dead. My men dead. I dead. You kill.
A destroyer wasn't exactly as good as sinking a nuclear-powered battle cruiser, McCafferty told himself. But it was a whole lot better than nothing, too. And a piece of another, he reminded himself. And who knows? Maybe that one sank on the way home.
Not too shabby, Dan, Sims observed.
Some people, said the skipper of HMS Oberon, have all the bloody luck.
You know, Todd, said the commanding officer of USS Chicago, this is pretty good beer.
USS Faris. There were only 2 bodies to bury. Another 14 men were missing and presumed dead. But for all that, Morris counted himself fortunate. 20 sailors were injured to one extent or another. Clark's broken forearm, a number of broken ankles from the shock of the torpedo impact, and a 6 bad scaldings from ruptured steam pipes. That didn't count minor cuts from flying glass. Morris read through the ceremony in the manual, his voice emotionless as he went through the words about the sure and certain hope of how the sea will one day give up her dead. On command, the seamen tilted up the mess tables.
The bodies wrapped in plastic bags and weighted with steel slid out from under the flags, dropping straight into the water. It was 10,000 feet deep here, a long last trip for his executive officer and a third-class gunner's mate from Detroit. The rifle salute followed, but not taps. There was no one aboard who could play a trumpet, and the tape recorder was broken. Morris closed the book. Secure and carry on. The flags were folded properly and taken to the sail locker. The mess tables were carried below, and the stanchions were replaced to support the lifelines. And USS Ferris was still only half a ship, fit only to be broken up for scrap, Morris knew. The tug, Papago, was pulling her backwards at just more than 4 knots. 3 days to shore. They were heading toward Boston, the closest port, rather than a naval base. The reason was clear enough. Repairs would take over a year, and the Navy didn't want to clutter up one of its own repair facilities with something that would take that long. Only those ships that could be repaired for useful war service would get rapid attention. Even his continued command of Ferris was a joke. The tug had a reserve crew, many of them salvage experts in civilian life. 3 of them were aboard to keep an eye on the towing cable and advise Morris on the things he had to do. Their pieces of advice were really orders, but polite ones. There were plenty of things to keep his crew busy. The forward bulkheads required constant watching and attention. Repairs were underway to the engine plant. Only one boiler was working, providing steam to turn the turbo generators and provide electrical power. The second boiler needed at least another day of work. His main air search radar, they said, would be working in 4 hours. The satellite antenna was just back online also. By the time they reached port, if they reached port, everything aboard that his crew could fix would be fixed. That didn't really matter, but a busy crew, the Navy has always said, is a happy crew. In practical terms, it meant that the crewmen, unlike their captain, did not have time to brood on what mistakes had been made, the lives that had been lost because of them, and who had made them. Morris went to the Combat Information Center. The tactical crew was rerunning the tape and paper record of the encounter with the Victor, trying to find what had happened. I don't know. The sonar operator shrugged. Maybe it was 2 subs, not just 1. I mean, here he is, right? This bright trail here. Then a couple minutes later, the active sonar picked him up over here. Only 1 sub, Morris said. Getting from here to there is about a 4-minute run at 25 knots.
But we didn't hear him, sir, and it don't show on the screen. Besides, he was heading the other way when we lost him.
The sonarman rewound the tape to run it all again. Yeah. Morris went back to the bridge, playing it over again in his mind. He had the entire sequence memorized now. He walked out on the bridge wing. The spray shields were still perforated, and there was a faint bloodstain where the XO had died. Someone would be painting over that today. Chief Clark had all kinds of work gangs going. Morris lit a cigarette and stared at the horizon. Reyðarvík, Iceland. The helicopter was the last warning they needed. Edwards and his party were heading northeast. They passed through an area of many small lakes, crossed a gravel road after waiting an hour to see what the traffic there was like, none, and began to traverse a series of marshes. By this time Edwards was thoroughly confused by the terrain. The mixture of bare rock, grassy meadows, lava fields, and now a freshwater marsh made him wonder if Iceland might not be the place where God had put everything that had been left over after the world was built. Evidently he'd made just the right amount of trees, though, because there were none here, and their best cover was the knee-high grass that sprouted from the water. It must be hardy grass, Edwards thought, since this marsh had been frozen not too long ago.
It was still cold, and within minutes of entering the marshes, everyone's legs ached with it. They endured the misery. The alternative was to travel on bare and slightly elevated ground, not something to be contemplated with enemy helicopters about. Vigda surprised them with her endurance. She kept up with the Marines without faltering or complaining. A true country girl, Edwards thought. She was still benefiting from a childhood of chasing the family sheep around, or whatever it was you did with sheep, and climbing these goddamned hills. "Okay, people, take 10," Edwards called. Immediately everyone looked for a dry spot to collapse. Mainly they found rocks. Rocks in a marsh, Edwards thought. Garcia kept watch with the purloined Russian binoculars. Smith lit up a cigarette. Edwards turned around to see Vigdis sitting down next to him. "How do you feel?"
"Very tired," she said with a slight smile. "But not so tired as you."
"Is that so?" Edwards laughed. "Maybe we should step up the pace."
"Where do we go?"
"We're going to Famsfjordr. I didn't say why. I figure another 4 or 5 days. We want to stay clear of all the roads we can."
"To protect me, yes?"
Edwards shook his head. "To protect all of us. We don't want to fight anybody. There's too many Russians around to play soldier games."
"So I don't hurt, stop you from important things?"
Vigdis asked. "Not at all. We're all happy to have you with us. Who wouldn't like a walk in the country with a beautiful girl?" Edwards asked gallantly. Was that a smart thing to say? She gave him a strange look.
"You think I'm pretty after...
Vigdis, if you were hit by a truck..." "Yes, you are very beautiful. No man could change that. What happened to you was not your fault. Whatever changes it made are inside, not outside. And I know somebody must like you."
"My baby, you mean?"
"Mistake.
He find another girl. This is not important. All my friends have babies."
She shrugged it off. "That stupid son of a bitch," Edwards thought. He remembered that bastardy carried no stigma on Iceland. Since no one had a surname, most of the Icelanders had given names followed by patronymics. You couldn't even tell the difference between the legitimate and illegitimate. Besides which, the Icelanders didn't seem to give a damn one way or the other. Young unmarried girls had babies, took proper care of them, and that was that. But who would walk away from this girl? "Well, speaking for myself, Vigdis, I've never met a girl prettier than you."
"Truly?"
Her hair looked like hell, tangled and filthy, Edwards admitted to himself. Her face and clothing were covered with dust and mud. A hot shower could change that in a few minutes, revealing the lovely thing that she was. But beauty comes from within, and he was only beginning to appreciate the person inside. He ran his hand along her cheek. "Any man who says different is an idiot." He turned to see Sergeant Smith coming over. "Time to move, unless you want our legs to stiffen up, Lieutenant." "Okay. I want to make another 8 or 10 miles. There's farms and roads on the far side of this mountain we're walking around. We'll want to eyeball that area before we try to cross it. I'll call in from there, too." "You got it, Skipper. Rogers, take the point and bend it a little west." Bodenberg, Federal Republic of Germany. The ride forward had not been an easy one. 8th Guards Army moved its forward command post as close behind the leading troops as possible. Its commander, like Alexeyev, believed in having his eyes and ears as close to the front as possible. The trip took 40 minutes in armored troop carriers. It was far too dangerous to use helicopters,
during which Alexeyev had observed a pair of savage air attacks on Russian columns. German and Belgian reinforcements had joined the action, and intercepts of radio messages indicated that American and British units were also en route. Alexeyev had called up more Russian units as well. What had begun as a relatively simple push by one mechanized army was now growing into a major engagement. He took this to be a good sign. NATO would not be reinforcing if they did not regard the situation as dangerous. The Soviet task was to achieve the desired result before reinforcements came into play. The general commanding 20th Guards Tank Division was in the command post. They'd set it up in a secondary school. A new building, it had lots of space, and until an underground bunker could be prepared, it would have to do. The pace of the advance had slowed, as much because of traffic control difficulties as from the Germans. "Straight down this road to Sak," 8th Guards Army told the tanker. "My motor rifle troops should have it clear by the time you get there."
4 kilometers to Alfeld.
"Yes. Just make sure you can support us when we jump across the river." The general set his helmet atop his head and moved out the door. It was going to work, Alexeyev thought. This general had done a magnificent job of delivering his unit to the front in nearly perfect order.
The next thing he heard was an explosion. Windows shattered. Pieces of ceiling dropped around him. The Devil's Cross had returned yet again.
Alexeyev raced outside to see a dozen burning armored vehicles. As he watched, the crew bailed out of a brand-new T-80 tank. An instant later, the vehicle brewed up. A fire swept through the ammunition racks inside, and a pillar of flame rose toward the sky as from a small volcano.
"The general is dead! The general is dead!" the sergeant shouted.
He pointed to a BMD infantry carrier from which no one had escaped alive. Alexeyev found the commander of the 8th Guards Army cursing beside him. "The assistant commander of that tank division is a new colonel." Pavel Leonidovich reached a quick and convenient decision.
"No, Comrade General. What about me?"
Startled, the commander stared at him, then remembered Alexeyev's reputation as a tank commander and his father's. He made a quick decision of his own.
20th Tanks is yours. You know the mission."
Another infantry assault carrier rolled up. Alexeyev and Sergeyev boarded it, and the driver sped off toward the divisional command post. It took half an hour before they stopped. Alexeyev saw rows of tanks parked inside the tree line. Allied artillery was falling close by, but he ignored it. His regimental commanders were grouped together. The general quickly gave orders for objective and timing. It spoke well of the general, not dead an hour, that everyone here knew his mission. The division was finally organized, with every part of the assault plan already firmed up. Alexeyev saw at once that he had a good battle staff. He set them to work as his unit commanders rejoined their regiments. His first battle headquarters was fittingly in the shade of a tall tree. His father could have wished for no better. Alexeyev smiled. He found his divisional intelligence officer.
"What's the situation?"
"A battalion of German tanks is counterattacking on this road leading east from Sak. They should be contained, and in any case our vehicles are moving southwest behind them. The lead motor rifle troops are just inside the town and report only minor resistance. Our leading elements are now moving and should be there within the hour."
"Air defense officer?"
"SAMs and mobile anti-aircraft guns are just behind the leading echelons. We also have friendly air cover. 2 regiments of MiG-21s are on call for air defense, but we haven't had any ground attack fighters assigned yet. They took a beating this morning. But so did the other side. We killed 12 NATO aircraft before noon."
Alexeyev nodded, dividing that number by 3, as he had learned.
"Excuse me, Comrade General. I am Colonel Popov, your divisional political officer."
Fine, Comrade Colonel. My party dues are paid to the end of the year, and with luck I will live to pay them again. If you have something important to say, be quick. If there was anything Alexeyev didn't need now, it was a Zampolit. After we capture Alfeld, if we capture Alfeld, I will let you have the keys to the city. For the present, let me do my job. Dismissed. Probably wanted permission to shoot suspected fascists. As a 4-star general, Alexeyev could not ignore political officers, but at least he could ignore those under the rank of general. He walked over to the tactical maps. On one side, as before, lieutenants showed the advance of his units. On the other, intelligence officers were assembling what data they had on enemy opposition. He grabbed the shoulder of his operations officer. I want that lead regiment right behind the motor rifle troops. If they need some help, give it to them. I want this breakthrough, and I want it today. What artillery do we have set up? 2 battalions of heavy guns are ready now. Good. If those infantry have targets for them, find out, and let's start hitting them now. This is not a time for finesse. NATO knows we're here, and our worst enemy is time. Time works for them, not for us. The operations officer and artillery commander got together, and 2 minutes later, his 152mm guns were delivering fire to the front. He'd have to have a medal awarded to the dead commander of 20th Tanks, Alexeyev decided. The man deserved a reward of some kind for the training he saw evident in this staff. "Enemy air attack in progress," a plotting officer said. "Enemy tanks emerging from woods east of Sak. Estimate battalion strength. Heavy artillery fire supporting the Germans." He had to trust his colonels now, Alexeyev knew. The time at which a general could observe the entire battle and control it was long past. His staff officers made their little marks on the map. The Germans should have waited, the general thought. They should have let the division spearhead go through, then attack the division supply column. That was foolish. The first time he had seen a German commander make a tactical error. Probably a junior officer who had relieved a dead or wounded superior, or perhaps a man whose home was nearby. Whatever the reason, it was a mistake, and Alexeyev was profiting by it. His leading 2 tank regiments took losses, but they smashed the German counterattack in 10 furious minutes.
2 kilometers. Leading elements now 2 kilometers from Sak. Opposition from artillery only. Friendly units are in sight. Infantry troops in Sak report minor resistance only. The town is nearly clear. Forward scouts report the road to Alfeld is open.
Bypass Sak, Alexeyev ordered. The objective is Alfeld on the line. Alfeld, Federal Republic of Germany. It was a scratch team. American mechanized infantrymen and the lead tank squadron of an advancing British brigade reinforced the remains of Germans and Belgians who had been crushed by 5 Soviet divisions that day. There was little time. Combat engineers worked furiously with their armored bulldozers to scrape shelters for the tanks, while infantrymen dug holes for their anti-tank weapons. A cloud of dust on the horizon was all the warning they needed. A division of tanks was reported heading their way, and the civilians had not entirely evacuated the town behind them. 20 miles behind them, a squadron of ground attack aircraft circled, waiting for the call-down signal.
"Enemy in sight,"
a lookout on a church steeple radioed. In seconds, artillery fire lashed at the leading Soviet columns. Anti-tank missile crews popped the covers off their targeting scopes and loaded the first weapons of what promised to be a long afternoon. The Challenger tanks of 3rd Royal Tank Regiment settled into their holes, hatches shut tight as the gunners zeroed their sights on distant targets. Things were too confused, and there had not been enough time to establish a firm chain of command here. An American was first to fire. The TOW-2 missile sped downrange, its control wires trailing out behind like a spider's web as it reached 4 kilometers to a T-80 tank.
"Advanced elements are now under fire from enemy missile teams," reported a plotting officer.
"Flatten them," Alexeyev ordered his artillery commander.
Within a minute, the division's multiple rocket launchers were filling the sky with trails of fire. Tube artillery fire added to the carnage at the battle line. Then NATO artillery joined the fray in earnest.
"Lead regiment is taking losses."
Alexeyev watched the map in silence. There was no room for deceptive maneuver here, nor was there time. His men had to race through the enemy lines as quickly as possible in order to seize the bridges on the line. That meant that his leading tank crews would suffer heavily. The breakthrough would have its own heavy price, but the price had to be paid. 12 Belgian F-16 fighters swept in low over the front at 500 knots, dropping tons of cluster munitions on the lead Soviet regiment, killing nearly 30 tanks and a score of infantry carriers less than a kilometer from the Allied lines. A swarm of missiles rose into the sky after them, and the single-engine fighters turned west, skimming over the ground in their attempt to evade. Three were smashed to the ground and fell among the NATO troops, adding to the carnage already created by Soviet fire. The commander of the British tanks saw that he lacked the firepower to stop the Soviet attack. There just wasn't enough. It was time to leave while his battalion was still able to fight. He alerted his companies to be ready to pull out and tried to get the word to neighboring units. But the troops around Alfeld came from four different armies, with separate languages and radio settings. There hadn't been time to establish exactly who was in overall command. The Germans didn't want to leave. The town had not yet been fully evacuated, and the German troops would not desert their positions until their countrymen were safely across the river. The Americans and Belgians began to move when the British colonel told them to, but not the Germans, and the result was chaos within the NATO lines.
"Forward observers report enemy units moving back on the right. Repeat, enemy units appear to be disengaging on the northern side of the town."
"Move the 2nd Regiment north. Loop around and head for the bridges, fast as they can. Disregard losses and charge for those damned bridges.
Operations officer, keep pressure on all enemy units. We want to trap them on this side and finish them if we can," Alexeyev ordered.
"Sergeyev, come with me. I have to go forward."
The attack had ripped the heart out of his lead regiment, Alexeyev knew, but it had been worth the cost. The NATO forces would have to move their units through a smashed town to get to the bridges, and having the Allied units on the north side disengage first was a godsend. Now, with a fresh regiment, he'd be able to run over them, and, if he were very lucky, get the bridges intact. This he'd have to supervise himself. Alexeyev and Sergeyev boarded a tracked vehicle, which motored southeast to catch the maneuvering regiment. Behind them, his operations officer began to give new orders over the divisional radio net. 5 kilometers on the far side of the river, a battery of German 155mm guns was waiting for this opportunity. They had remained silent, waiting for their radio intercept experts to pin down the divisional headquarters. Quickly, the gunners punched the target data into their fire control computers, while others loaded high-explosive shells. Every gun in the battery trained out on an identical azimuth. The ground shook when they began rapid fire. 100 shells fell in and around the divisional headquarters in less than 2 minutes. Half the battle staff was killed outright, most of the others wounded. Alexeyev looked at his radio headset. His third close brush with death. "That was my fault. I should have checked the sighting of the radio transmitters. I must not make that mistake again. Damn, damn, damn!" Alfeld's streets were clogged with civilian vehicles. The Americans in their Bradley-tracked vehicles avoided the town entirely, hurrying down the right bank of the Lina and crossing to the other side in good order. There they took positions on the hills overlooking the Lina, and set up to cover the crossing of the other Allied troops.
The Belgians were next. Only a third of their tanks had survived, and these covered the southern flank on the far side of the river, hoping to stop the Russians before